The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Legal Forum. And we look forward to hearing from Ian Powell as we continue our look at the New Testament book of 1 John. And if you haven't been here for a little while at the Legal Forum, welcome back. Now, Ian is going to speak. He's going to read the text, so there's nothing more to do there. The usual drill, if you've got comments or questions, please use those slips of paper in front of you, and Ian will do his best to respond, and we'll be all done by about 20 past the hour. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you. Well, this passage that I'll read out in a moment is one of extraordinary clarity, almost fierce clarity about the world in which you live and the relationship in which you stand with God. And yet it is also one of the most troubling and confusing of passages in many ways. So I became a, when I did my movement from atheism to then believing in God and then deciding in the end that Jesus was the way in which you could know God objectively and really, I came home, I'd begun to read the Bible, I bought a Bible one day, I was working at Centrepoint Tavern. I was not a great reader, but I was just getting bored in the bus very early in the morning. I didn't have time to get to the newsagent to buy Rugby League Week, which was my one weekly read. And so I thought I'd buy a book. I walked into, they used to have these things called bookstores in Sydney, quite a few of them. And I bought a real live book. I think it was probably the first book I'd ever bought. But I went, I thought I'd just find a book to read, you know. And I didn't realize how much they cost. And the only book I could afford to buy was the New Testament. I'm kind of sad I've given it away. But so I bought this book. I hid it under my bed because I was sharing a bedroom with my brother, who was kind of my hero. And he hated Christianity, so I hid it under my bed where you normally put your Playboy magazine or something like that. And when Ross wasn't there, I would get it out and surreptitiously read this book. At the same time, I'd been having a series of ongoing debates with Christians, only the difference was that in the few months at the end of high school and then going on into my brief skirmish at University of New South Wales, I was now arguing with a view to learn, arguing with a view to know, is this true, rather than with a view to just smashing it down and showing how clever I was. And I remember I was just reading through 1 John, I was dog-earing, you know, pages, as you do if you're a high-quality person, and reading the next section. And I came home one day, at that stage I was working at the Rose Bay Drive-In liquor store, and I came home, slipped out my banned literature, began to read it, and read this passage. And it just smashed my world, really, in a helpful way. Because I was at the point where I kind of knew it was true. I kind of didn't want it to be true, but it was true. And I had found myself, sometimes when I was, my mind had been seriously shaped by various external chemicals that I'd taken, but at various parties arguing the case for Christianity against friends who didn't, but thinking, this is crazy, what am I doing? Because I was sort of convinced it was probably true. I certainly knew the arguments normally used against it by people like me and my peers were just foolish, but I certainly wasn't Christian. And I think I thought I was like Switzerland in the Second World War. You know, neutral but kind of leaning to the good guys. And then I read this passage, and I just realized let me read part of it to you. We'll skip the part which we did last week, which is really a little excursus where John got a little excited and couldn't help himself but talk about how wonderful it is to be adopted. But if you go back to chapter, at the very top of the page, 229, just to listen to the argument that this friend of Jesus uses. Because this is a very Jesus argument. You can generally speaking work out that the more our culture hates an argument, the more closely tied it is to what Jesus says. Because what John is doing here is exactly what Jesus says in John chapter 8, this sort of argument. So he says in chapter 2:29, if you know that he is righteous, you know that everyone also who does righteousness is born of him. See how great a love the Father has bestowed on us. Down to verse 4. Everyone who does sin also does lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. You know that he appeared in order to take away sin, and in him there is no sin. No one who abides in him sins. No one who sins has seen him or knows him. Verse 7. Little children, make sure no one deceives you. The one who does righteousness is righteous, just as he is righteous. The one who does sin is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. The Son of God appeared for this purpose, to destroy the works of the devil. No one who is born of God does sin. Because his seed abides in him, he cannot sin, because he is born of God. By this the children of God and the children of the devil are obvious. Anyone who does not do righteousness is not of God, nor the one who does not love his brother. For this is the message which you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. Now there are some very strong statements there, aren't there, of either orness. If you got the email that we sent out, let people know this is on. I quoted from verse 10. By this the children of God and the children of the devil are obvious. I mean, who thinks to divide the world into those sort of categories? You're either a child of God or a child of the devil. There is no Switzerland at that point. Axis or allies is basically it's saying. And it's this whole passage is dealing with the connection between knowing God and righteous living. Righteous is not a word that I think most of us like. Righteousness has a sense of harshness, perhaps. The African Americans have got a phrase that they'll sometimes compliment someone and say, he's a righteous brother. It's a phrase that hasn't caught on in our culture, which wouldn't do us any harm. And the idea is that he's a brother who won't do you harm. A righteous brother is someone who will keep his deals and promises. A righteous brother is someone you can trust because he'll do the right thing in the relationship. And that is exactly what the Bible has in mind when it speaks of God as a righteous God. He will do that which is right in relationships. He will keep his promises. He will honor his word. He is faithful even when we're faithless. He is righteous. Even if we are unrighteous, he remains righteous. And that's a good and relieving thing to know that that's true. But then what it says is in verse 29 of chapter 2, because as I've mentioned, verses 1 to 3, although they're perhaps some of my most favouritest verses in the whole of the Bible, verses 1 to 3 can be left out of the argument in a sense. If you know that he is righteous, so he said, if you know that God is righteous, he said, well, you can know something logically that follows. You know that everyone who does righteousness is born of him. Christians, he says, a genuine Christian, as against the stuff that the false teachers who've left the church are saying, is known by what they believe about Jesus. It's one of the great tests. And secondly, by how they live. As Jesus says repeatedly, you can tell a tree from its fruit. He says that particularly at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, which we might come back to. There is an unbreakable connection between right relationship with God and righteous living. One of the lovely things to note, though, with Jesus-type righteousness can be cold and ugly and judgmental. That's why I think if someone says, you're being pretty righteous, aren't you? It's probably an insult in our culture. But the righteousness of the Bible, you can see from verse 10, is tied up essentially with the question of love. You can see that at the very end of chapter 10, he goes from righteousness to love instinctively, because that's what a righteous person is. A person who's genuinely righteous is a loving person, is a generous person and a gracious person. That's the mark of right. And you see this so beautifully with Joseph. Joseph is he's engaged. Well, he's not engaged. The system that they had in Judaism was much more powerful. He was betrothed to Mary. That is, they'd actually taken marriage vows, but they weren't living together. So it's a middle step between engagement and marriage, which we don't have in our culture. So if you wanted to break off a betrothal, it was a divorce. So you hadn't lived together, you hadn't had sex together, but you were bound to each other by promise, and God takes promises seriously. When Joseph discovers that Mary is pregnant and he knows he hasn't had sex with her, there can only be one explanation, and that is that she is, even at this stage, hopefully a fresh love, she's been unfaithful to him and she's committed, therefore, adultery. And we're told in the Gospels that because he was a righteous man, he ended the marriage, ended the betrothal, secretly and quietly. We would tend to think a righteous man would publicly humiliate her, which he could. He could actually put her life in serious jeopardy by saying, this woman is pregnant, she was betrothed to me, she wasn't married to me, therefore she's an adulteress and her life is in serious jeopardy. But instead, because he's righteous, he does bring the relationship to an end, not inappropriately, I would have thought. You know, someone has done that, it's not an inappropriate thing to say, well, something's not right here about this relationship, let's bring this to an end. But he does it quietly, he does it gently, to save her life and to save her from shame and embarrassment. That's what a righteous brother does. Right? It's not an ugly thing. And it's very clear here that according to 1 John, someone who knows God is a righteous brother or a righteous sister. Well, let's have a look at how he does this. In verse 3, because we're adopted by God into the family and we're now his children, daughters and sons, and because we've got this magnificent future where we shall become like Jesus, the result, he says, is that we should purify ourselves as he is pure. This is the motivation to live purely, to remove those things from our life that are unchristlike, that are unrighteous. And then he goes into verse 4. Everyone who does sin also does lawlessness. Sin is lawlessness. And I want to suggest here is the key, I think, to understanding the very puzzling verse to say in verse 6. No one who abides in him sins. Abiding in him, that is living in relationship with Jesus, is one of John's favourite, one of Jesus' favourite descriptions. What it is to be Christian? It's to have been sort of, it's like a branch that's been grafted into a vine. You are now part of the vine. There's this sort of organic unity, and the life of the vine is now pumping through you. He says, if you're in that sort of relationship, no one who abides in him sins. No one who sins has seen him or knows him. Now that's troubling, isn't it? Because if you know yourself at all, and you know what God says about you and says about how to live, you will have a sense of sin. I think it's one of the marks of spiritual life, is a sense of the fact that you sin. One of the marks of someone who is blind as a bat is someone who has no sense of sin and failure before God. That's what sin is. But it's important to see the definition here that he's using. Everyone who does sin also does lawlessness. Here's the key thing. Sin is lawlessness. Now that's critical, that's deep, that's ugly. There are about 20 words in the Old Testament that when the Jews translated into Greek in the Septuagint, they used this word anomia, lawlessness, to describe it. And lawlessness does not mean breaking the law. That's a different category completely. Someone who is breaking the law is not lawless. Lawless is a much deeper and more wicked category. It's not saying that you break the law, but you utterly defy the law. You are lawless. That you're saying, I acknowledge no law above myself. I am the only law in my part of the universe. It is captured beautifully in many of our favourite songs. When I was a young heathen, and my father and mother would restrict my freedoms cruelly and brutally. I didn't know about docs then, or I could have dealt with them. When Dad would sometimes say, no, you can't have that, and no, you can't have the car, and no, you can't have the money that I should give you, so you can waste it, I would sometimes go into the lounge room, get my brother's little 45 record. This is, you have to look this up on the Wikipedia if you know it. I'd put the needle onto it, and it was an Eric Burden and the Animal song, and the chorus was, it's my life and I'll do what I want. Show me I'm wrong. Now, I couldn't do what I wanted because Daddy had to feed me and clothe me, etc. But I just knew this was a brutal injustice because it was my life. And I had a right and a duty to do whatever I damn well wanted. And he was an evil man to place his law above me. You see it also in Frank Sinatra, one of the songs that Dad used to enjoy listening to. And I did it my... That is the worst song to have played as your funeral's taken out of that thing, because you don't want to have that song, as it were, ringing in God's ears when you stand before him. It's a classic statement of lawlessness. It's saying, my way, not your way. So the story of Adam and Eve, so simple, seemingly, and yet so unspeakably profound. The sad thing with my friends who just mock it before they even bother trying to understand it is, it's the classic description of what the essence of sin is. There's nothing wrong with picking fruit from a tree. There's nothing inherently wicked, socially destructive in that. Because that's not what sin is. If you want to understand the fundamental problem that you have and that human life has and human society has and international politics has, it's the thing that says to God, God, you do not have the right to tell me what is good and evil. I will determine what is good, what is evil. That, to us, we think that's sort of moral maturity, growing up to autonomy. It's not. It's the very heart of darkness. It's lawlessness that says to God, there is no law over me except my own. Which, of course, the sad thing that is you're just such an obvious replica of your culture. You know, in the end, everyone's saying, no, I think to myself, no, you don't. We're much more culturally conditioned than we think we are. Society is a prison without walls. And so much of what we think of as our own invention about morals and ethics is a carbon copy of the dominant voices in our part of society. That's what sin is. And if you are born of God, if you've come in a relationship with God, you don't do lawlessness. You may sometimes break God's law, but that is entirely different. In various times when I've played sport, etc., and we've got various weaknesses. I had various weaknesses in my rowing style. I remember that our rowing coach, who I think was a bit of a psychopath, in my last years of school, smashing his foot into the boat and smashing his fist on the front of the boat and saying, Powell, I'll make an oarsman out of you if it kills me. Right? Oarsman is what you call someone who really can row. Right? That's you aspire to be, not just a rower, but an oarsman. Because I never arrived. Did I try? I tried my guts out. I really tried to not, you know, slew my shoulders away at the wrong time and finish with it nice and high and all that sort of stuff. But I was not lawless. I was trying really, really hard. But I failed. Lawlessness is when you just say, I don't care what you think, Norm. Shut your face, you old man. What do you know? I'll row how damn well I like. And when I like. That's lawlessness. That gets you out of the crew instant. In fact, you never get into a crew if you don't. But you see the difference between law-breaking and lawlessness. And that's what he's got in mind here. And he's saying, you can be lawless before God and be a thoroughly decent, nice member of our community most of the time. But you are lawless. In terms of God, whose world it is, and whose view is that really the view that matters most, unless, of course, you're lawless, right? And godless. The most serious descriptions of wickedness is godlessness and lawlessness. So he says that's what sin is. So if you reread the whole passage and replace his own given definition of sin, I think the passage makes sense. In fact, it makes very clear sense. He says, verse 5, you know that he appeared, goes straight from the problem of sin to Jesus, the obvious place to go, because the Bible is into answers, not just constantly sort of sloshing around in the problem. You know that he appeared, that's Christmas, in order to take away lawlessness. And in him there is no lawlessness. No one who abides in him lawlesses. No one who does lawlessness has either seen him or no one. Little children, make sure no one deceives you. The one who does righteousness is righteous just as he is righteous. The one who does lawlessness is of the devil. For the devil has lawless from the beginning. The Son of God appeared for this purpose, to destroy the works of the devil. No one who is born of God does lawlessness, because God's seed abides in him, and he cannot lawless, because he is born of God. You see, it's not... The fear people have with this passage is it's saying, to use a sort of semi-technical thing, it's saying, unless you are sinlessly perfect, you're not a Christian. And you can get that if you read it carelessly. If you don't ask John, what do you mean by sin? Not what do I think sin is, but what do you think sin is? And he gives you the definition. It's lawlessness. It's gross wickedness. It's not used very often in the New Testament. Interestingly, terrifyingly, it's used in what I find probably the most frightening passage in the Bible, from Matthew 7, where Jesus talks about the last judgment day and he's judging, which is the place that only God belongs. And he says, on that day, many will say to me, but Lord, we preached in your name. You know, we did miracles in your name, etc. But I will say to them, depart from me, I never knew you. You doers of lawlessness. Right? So you may have done spiritual stuff, religious stuff. You may have been famous or infamous for your preaching or your miracle working, etc. But for Jesus, the question is, are you lawless? And that's why people are sent away in horror. And the concern that 1 John has here is the same concern Jesus has, is that you not be deceived. It is no cruelty to warn someone of a possible deception. It's accidental hatred to not tell them. And the danger is, as we're told in verse 7, is that people can try and convince themselves that you can know God and be forgiven of God and it not affect your living. That's just a pure deception. Now, I do need to finish fairly soon, but let me just draw your attention to the most staggering part of verse 3 here. I think it's a long time ago. I think these are the verses that got me. Because it now goes from sin as lawlessness, wickedness, that's wicked enough. But now it says, if you're involved in that way of life, if you are not committed to living joyfully and consciously under the laws of the Creator, it's not just that you are lawless, it's worse. Verse 8. The one who does lawlessness, the one who does sin, is of the devil. For the devil has lawlessed from the beginning. The Son of God appeared for this purpose, to destroy the works of the devil. No one born of God does sin. Verse 10. By this the children of God and the children of the devil are obvious. Anyone who does not do righteousness is not of God. I think this is probably the verses that actually smashed through my Switzerland and thankfully overturned my boat at that time. And then I remember coming back to it, having been a Christian, while thinking, is this the passage that seemed so clear to me that I had to change? I had to read it more carefully. But the overwhelming point of saying simply this is that you are, if you're committed to a life where you do your own thing and you're the determinant of right and wrong, right? Lawlessness, you are of the devil. It's not saying you're Satan worship. It was interesting, last night George and I went to a high cultural event and saw the Rolling Stones, and one of the great numbers they finished up with was, and it was Sympathy for the Devil. Well, I don't kind of enjoy the song very much. I was listening to it. It was very well done for a bunch of old fellas last night, where Mick Jagger sort of, you know, talking about what the devil has done and says, you know, have you guessed my name? What's the nature of my game? Etc., etc. And it's, I don't think he's at that point, because he portrays a lot of ugly stuff the devil has done, you know. From the Russian Revolution to the World War II to the shooting of the Kennedys, etc. And, you know, but the devil is this person who I believe in because Jesus believes in. And I believe that you can be a child of the devil, even as you are in some ways a decent person. I believe it not just because John says it here, that you are either a child of God or a child of the evil one, but because in John 8 Jesus says exactly that. And he says it to a bunch of very decent people, the Pharisees, who, as we've talked about, we tend to go boo hiss, but in their own day they were the best of the best. They were good men. They weren't even professional priests. They loved God for free, and they did it in their spare time. And yet Jesus says, you are of your father, the devil. He hints at, if you read John 8, it's a wonderful passage to read. It starts with that story of Jesus' grace to the woman caught in adultery. Then it's got Jesus saying, I'm the light of the world. It's his great offer of freedom. They get very offended. They say, we're the children of Abraham. We've never been anyone's slave, which is ironic when you look at, they're just about enslaved by everybody. But that's what they say. Jesus questions their fatherhood from Abraham. He keeps saying, my father, your father. And in the end, he makes it clear, you are of your father, the devil. Your desire is to do the work of your father. He is a murderer and a liar. And that is one of the best descriptions of what the devil does. His intent is always to murder, to destroy life, and ultimately to rob you of life. And he does it not by demon possession, unless he has to, but just by lying to you. And lying to you about the way you can live and the nature of God. That God is worth avoiding rather than following. And he's saying, this is what Jesus is saying here, this is what John's saying, directly reflecting his master and his friend's words, that you are one or the other. Now, we can ask all sorts of interesting philosophical questions about that, not an appropriate so long as we realize that if we do that, we're completely missing the point of the passage. This is an existential, deeply personal, deeply practical thing. John and God through John wants you to work out, do I have the evidence of the life of God in me? Is his seed in me? You plant a seed in the soil, you transform everything. Right? You plant the wrong seed next to a pavement or next to a house, you can tear the house apart. The thing with the seed, as it talks about here, when it says, verse 9, no one who is born of God sins because his seed abides in him, so he cannot lawless. The undergirding thing here is that we know God partly because we've been born of him. My daughters and I have ongoing jokes, particularly the two younger ones, about fruit and tree. So when I chip my youngest daughter, who we have a really fun sort of lot of rudeness to each other. I don't know if that's appropriate, but that's what we do. When she's particularly rude, and then I'll say, "Ooh," and she'll say, "Apple doesn't fall far from the tree, does it?" And on it goes. And there are times when I'll be talking to one of the daughters, and I'll say something I think, and they'll say, "That is exactly what I think." And it kind of spooks us all. You've probably seen this study or heard of the very famous Minnesota twin study, which is just freakish. The way in which identical twins, that is, who come from the same seed, the same egg, that its first thing is to divide into two people rather than just to multiply. The similarities they have in the sort of car that they buy. These are identical twins who are then adopted out and brought up in totally different families. The sort of cars they buy, the sort of women, because they're particularly the blokes as the ones I've been in, the sort of women that they like, the shape of the women that they like, the names they give to their children, which is utterly spooky. And it's to do with the seed that's in them. And he's saying here that God has put his seed into you if you trust Jesus. And it just changes you from the inside. You might not be conscious of it, but it's not just that we're inspired by the life of Jesus, which we are. It's not just that we're listening to the teaching of Jesus, but his seed is in us, and the seed will grow, right? And it will do its creative work and bring us life. So let's be clear. It is, whether we like it or not, an either-or-ness. You are either a child of God or a child of the devil. And we need to see that's the shape of the world we live in. It's psychologically uncomfortable to believe that. It's hard just to have, you know, a relaxed life if you realize that the stakes are so high, that the black is so black and the white is so white. But that seems to be what John's saying. And he says, don't let anyone deceive you. Right? A couple of verses before these ones, he starts off with that and it comes up in the middle. Well, I should be quiet now so there's some time for questions, although I'm sure there's none.
Just the usual suspects asking questions.
Three from one, but if you want to mix them up.
Read them out.
Alright. What are some examples of the main lies the devil tells his children? What are the examples of the main lies the devil tells his children? The fundamental lie, or cluster of lies, is found in that, in Genesis 3. Right? You need not fear disobeying God. You will not die. That there is no judgment. So sad when people speak as if, oh, we're far too modern to believe in judgment. Yeah, that's really modern, boys. It goes right back to the garden. And you can see it even in the 7th century BC prophets, where the Israelis, the Jews are saying to their prophets God has sent them, do not speak like that. God will not act like that. The disbelief in judgment, which sadly even some Christians embrace, and the disbelief that God is good. The temptation said to Adam and Eve is that their life would be expanded if they just disobey God, that God's commands are to restrict you and hold you down. The secondary lie that comes up once God appears in Jesus is to the unforgivable sin that Jesus talks about, is where you turn the obvious evidence that this is God's visitation to the earth. You just use all of your brain power to avoid the evidence. That seems to be the way in which the devil works. But it's mostly about don't take the judgment seriously and do not believe God is good. Sin is lawlessness. Does lawlessness presuppose a civilized society? Now, it presupposes a civilized universe. It presupposes that there's a God who owns the universe. and it is completely right that we pay attention to what he says and that we not pretend that the universe is not owned. So we had that magnificent news today that the Rosetta space thing has got this little critter down onto this ice thing. I mean, that's exciting. They just landed on another part of God's real estate. Who owns that thing? God does. And we're welcome to explore it. But it's his. As I am, as you are. So it's not so much a civilized society at all, but it's a civilized universe, a civil universe. That is, that God owns it and speaks of love in it. Does sin only exist in a civilized society? I think I've probably answered that. No. Well, I suppose Adam and Eve, two people as a society, isn't it? The difficulty with God is, the difficulty for us with God is, lawlessness is all about God, right? Lawlessness is all about your neighbour, which is why in verse 10 he goes from righteousness to love of neighbour. Because at one level the Bible says, you want to know if you love God? How do you treat your neighbour? But it also says, do you want to know how to love your neighbour? We'll get this in 1 John 5. Do you want to know how to love your neighbour? Obey God. So God is not so silly to say, just you make the rules up as you go. He gives us wisdom and guidance along the way. Should Christians, children of God, ever directly tell non-believers that they are the children of the devil? If yes, how? Or is this for Christians to self-examine our conduct and our love? Good question, by which I don't mean the other questions aren't. Actually, this particularly catches my fancy. It's not the first thing I'd be telling my friends and family who aren't Christian, that they're children of the devil, although it might be appropriate. I think often Christians, because you know, you hang around with God long enough and you see what you become kinder. Oh, that's certainly what's happened to me. You see, what a horror you must have been before you met God. You become kinder and more sensitive to the feelings of others rather than getting grumpier and harsher, which I've seen some people do as they get older, and more cynical. And it becomes harder to say disruptive words. But I have many stories in my own life and in the lives of others where someone has dared to say the most offensive and confronting thing because they were asked and they said yes, and there's been an explosion, but it's done good. So there may be some times when you might share that, as Jesus does in John 8. He's not talking to Christians there, but he's talking to people who value God, and he's saying, you think you're in line with Abraham, you think you're friends with God, you're of the devil. No wonder at the end of the chapter they try to kill him. But it does good. And I think we should do it gently, and as people have said, greater ones than I, with sorrow, not with anger. Not saying, you're just a dirty son of the devil. That, at that point, even if that the content is true, the manner is wicked. If you use it as a weapon to bash people. But to say it tearfully, like telling someone they've got cancer, yeah. Let's take some of this. Are we obliged to love the children of the devil as brothers? Not as brothers, but we are obliged to love. The Bible is quite one of the things I think which worries people about either or thoughts. They don't like the idea of the sort of exclusive sort of claims about God. You're either with God or against God, that sort of thing that Jesus does say at one point. He's got classic Jesus. If you are not for me, you are against me. If you're not gathering men to me, you're scattering them. And then in a different context, he says, if you're not against me, you're for me. Where the disciples try to shut down someone else doing miracles in Jesus' name because they're not actually, you know, part of the society, or they haven't paid their... They're not hanging with Jesus. But Jesus says, no, that's okay. But Jesus is quite clear that there is an either-or-ness, two roads, two crowds, two destinations from the end of the Sermon on the Mount. But the thing that people need not fear is that what disciples of Jesus do is they love everyone. They love, as Jesus does, they love those who are opposed to God. They love them enough to speak the truth. They love them enough to pray. They love them enough to be kind. Jesus says, love your enemies. I think the thing people fear is that if you have the either-or-ness, you'll therefore dehumanize the other, which is very common, right? That the others are treated... This is what worried me about the last Planet of the Apes movie. The good guy in the Planet of the Apes movie, at the last moment, treats one of the other apes as if he's not an ape. And yet he's... So I'm trying to work out when the next movie... are we going to see that this was a dark act of corruption? You know, that sort of thing where you say, you're not really a human. Therefore, I don't have to treat you well. The boss says, no, that, you can't do that. So you always love the children of the devil. Because, I mean, I was myself a child of the devil in this way for many years. And it was the love of Christians who put up with my unbearable arrogance. And if you've tried to argue with people who are young, arrogant, and off their face, it's very annoying. But the way in which Christians did this to me was quite extraordinary. As a Christian, do we have any human rights? Well, human rights, that's an interesting... Of course, I think we have, in our society, said the human rights. Insofar as it's possible to speak about human rights, of course we do, and so do those who aren't. One of the first times I ever heard an Islamic spokesman speak about human rights was so many decades ago now. I knew nothing about Islam, but they had a big conference in Rome. This is probably back in the 80s or the 90s, and on Islamic human rights. And the ABC journalist was interviewing, and they said, "Oh yes, Islam believes very strongly in human rights, but the only people who are truly human are Muslim. It's not until you become a Muslim that you are truly human, because..." And therefore, and I thought, and that this is what I remember speaking into the radio, but they didn't hear me, saying to the journalist, "Ask a question about that. That's frightening." Now, I'm not saying that is the universal view of Muslim, but it was out of a leading conference of their academics. They were Sunnis, I think. But that was kind of scary, because that's the classic either orness. These ones are humans. It's kind of the way in which the Nazis end up dealing with the Jews, isn't it? That they weren't really human, therefore, what does it matter what you do? I think one of the distinctives of Christianity is we understand everyone who's made by God maintains those rights. Our last question. There's three questions. I'm confused by 1 John 6 and 9. Let's just do with this lastly. John is discussing... Can I just to go back to this, just to try and be clear... I've printed down the bottom there in smaller type a passage that we looked at a few weeks ago, which is where John very clearly says we have all sinned and we all have the problem of sin in ourselves. It's impossible to take John's whole teaching and come up with what's called sinless perfectionism, which is plagues Christianity sometimes, which you can get with the idea is you can be sinless and perfect. In fact, you must be. 6 and 9 are the verses that are most troubling. I've mentioned to you the definition of sin to use John's definition of sin, which he gives you in verse 4, as lawlessness. And I haven't been lawless since 1974. I've had moments where I've broken God's law, far too many, every day I would think, at various levels. But I haven't been lawless in that way. But the other thing it uses, and this is the thing that most scholars will draw your attention to, and because I'm not a scholar, I haven't done that, unfortunately. And that is that the words for sinning are in the present tense. The general consensus of Greek scholars is that the present tense in the Greek is a present, continuous, ongoing pattern word. It's as against the aorist tense, which is what they call a punctiliar tense. So it's not saying a Christian doesn't sin. It's saying a Christian doesn't sin. That's simply not his or her default position. Our default position is to seek to do what is good and right and loving and honouring to God. That's our default position. Do we fail? Yes. In the same way as the best athletes and the best musicians. I heard a brilliant rendition of some piano piece, which I can't remember when I was in school, but absolutely wonderful young piano player at school. I'd actually picked up by accident, hadn't given him a scholarship, which is nice. And I went to see him afterwards, absolutely blown away by the music and by the fact that he was a kid doing it, basically. He was so angry with himself. You know, he was just inconsolable with the mistakes he'd made. Exactly the mistakes his tutor told him not to do. And I think there was some perfectionism issues there, perhaps. But it was interesting that he was magnificent, and yet all he noticed was his mistakes. Now, at one level, it's right to notice, but it's also right to notice that you're doing well. I think sometimes people who become Christians, all they notice is their mistakes and don't realise the times when they have been loving, more loving than they would ever have been, have been forgiving, or even trying to be forgiving rather than just taking revenge, or trying to be generous.
So that's, I think it's saying this present ongoing, this is the pattern of life. Well, thank you for your patience. Wonderfully clear passage, and at the same time, a little bit confusing.
Thank you, Ian. As I mentioned last week or the week before, I think it was, that sadly Ian will be leaving at the end of this year, going to Canberra. If you weren't aware of that news, he'll be taking up a post in Wanneyasa. So I do take the opportunity over the next few weeks to chat to Ian about that. But he will be here for another three more weeks, three more Thursday mornings, and we are negotiating coming back next year at various times. So you can help me in that negotiation. Okay, have a good day.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.